Well, in this part of Focus 580, we're pleased to have here as our guest, writer Susan Power. She's here visiting the campus as part of the Fall Carr Reading Series. This is for 2007, fall 2007. This is presented by the English Department's Creative Writing Program. And throughout the year, at least in the fall and the spring, they bring writers to the campus so that students who are learning to write, working on their writing skills, can talk with them and they can get some feedback. And then also, the writers always do a reading, and Susan will indeed be giving a reading today at 4:30 in the afternoon in the author's corner of the Illini Union Bookstore. That's on South Wright. So anyone who's interested can stop by and meet her and hear her read from some of her work. Let me tell you just a little bit about her. She has a law degree from Harvard Law School, but left a career in law to pursue creative writing. Her fiction has appeared in a number of places, including Atlantic Monthly, Paris Review, and selected for inclusion in the Best American Short Stories. Her first novel was published in 1994. That's The Grass Dancer, and it won the Penn Hemingway Award. Her most recent is Roofwalker. That came out in 2002. She is an enrolled member of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, and she makes her home in St. Paul, Minnesota. And she's visiting here, and we're very pleased to have her here on the program. Questions are welcome, too, if people would like to call in. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
Oh, we certainly appreciate it. You are Native American, and the people that you write about in your books are Native Americans, so you're telling Native American stories. And I think that I read somewhere that you preferred not to be introduced as a Native American writer. Is that right?
I probably did say that, but, you know, I'm changing as I get older, and now I don't mind.
Well, it's okay now. All right.
Yeah, although I'm usually pretty easygoing as it is. But I do want to say one thing. While most of my main characters are Native American, I grew up in the city of Chicago, and I was exposed to so many different people from different backgrounds and races. So actually, there are always characters in my writing who are African American, white, what have you. So it's a pretty diverse lot.
Yeah. Well, is there a particular kind of story that you really like to tell?
Not really. I don't have an agenda ahead of time. Mm-hmm. I write probably what you would call character-driven fiction, in that characters come to me first before themes or ideas. And so I have to do a lot of work to figure out, okay, who are these people? What happens to them? Because, of course, you want to have something happen. but it always starts there, and it comes unbidden. So characters will sort of show up and haunt me until I figure out what's going on with them, what's their story. I usually have to do an awful lot of research. So I'm somebody who feels now like an employee. I am in service to my characters. They tell me what to do. When I have my own ideas about what they should do and who they should be with and when I try to write with my own agenda in mind, it just sounds awful. So I end up having to rewrite. So, yeah.
Well, it seems to me that a lot of your stories deal with very basic people who are thinking about very basic questions like, who am I? What kind of life do I want to lead? In what way am I connected to the people that went before me? A lot of stories have to do with love. Obviously, people looking for love and looking for partners and wondering about happiness and what it is and either do I have it or do I not? How does it elude me sometimes? That strikes me as being pretty universal to human experience. I guess that gets back to this idea that, you know, you wouldn't want people just to think, oh, well, this is about Native Americans. In a sense, yes, it is. But the stories that you're telling are about the stuff that everybody, doesn't matter who you are, the stuff that everybody really deals with.
Well, I'm thrilled that you mentioned that because while I no longer have any problem whatsoever being labeled as a Native American writer, I absolutely am hoping always that people won't be too distracted by the different culture, the exotica, to fail to recognize that really what I'm writing about are the relationships people have within their families, the challenges and also the wonderful things that happen, and which anyone can identify with. Sort of like Amy Tan and the Joy Luck Club and other books of hers. People, once they look beyond the fact that she's writing about Chinese and Chinese Americans, well, really she's writing about mothers and daughters and husbands and wives. But sometimes people can sort of be so distracted by the fact that, wait, these people are telling stories that aren't familiar to us. They sort of forget that we're all in this together. We're all humans. We really have more in common than we have differences.
I suppose it has to be the case, though, that some readers, whether they're reading you or they're reading Amy Tan or something that is about people that come from a different place than they do, that part of what attracts them to the writing has to be the exotica. In a sense, they're really, and not that there's anything, you know, wrong with that. Mm-hmm. You know, people looking for the feeling that they're maybe getting a window into somebody else's culture that's different from theirs. That's, you know, you might even argue, well, that's a good thing.
Well, absolutely. And that's the glory of our country. That's the glory of many universities across the country, the diversity. And, you know, I went to Harvard for college and then stayed there for law school. And I remember freshman week, our professors and the administrative folk telling us that we would learn more from each other in the dining room than we would in any classroom setting. And that turned out to be very much the case. We all came in there feeling that we knew an awful lot. You know, we sort of had it pegged. We understood life. We knew what we believed and what we didn't believe in. And then we were challenged constantly by people we respected. And that is an education, I think. That's what it's all about. It's not just everyone learning the same thing. It's having people challenge your ideas and your stories, your faith with their own ideas, not to cancel yours out, but so that you grow as a person and become perhaps, hopefully, a more flexible person. That's certainly what happened to me. Mm-hmm. And so that happens, too, in the literary community. You don't want to just read the same stories. How many stories set in New York with a disaffected couple can we read? You know, it gets a little bit boring sometimes, you know.
Yeah. So your mom is Native American. Your dad is not. Right. So as you were growing up in Chicago and as a girl and as a teenager, how did you connect with the Native American part of you?
Actually, the question is, how did I in any way connect with the white side of the family? Because I was raised Native first. My father had left the East Coast and was he just wasn't interested in his background, in his family stories. His ancestors came to this continent in the 1600s, and my mother, the Native American, is the one who was interested in his family stories. And so he died when I was a little girl. I was 11, and his mother died the same year. And my mother was the one who rescued all of the white family's papers so that I would know about that side of the family. But really, I was raised to think of myself as Indian, first and foremost. And that's the side I knew about. And so perhaps part of my going to Massachusetts and going to Harvard was groping my way towards immersing myself for a time in that side of the family.
Yeah. Having done that, having gone to Harvard Law School, how did you then make this transition or change in direction from being somebody who would have been a lawyer, I suppose, or at least working in the law? I suppose you could have gone on and been a law professor. You could have done a lot of different things. Going from that to then having writing really be the focus.
I'd written all of my life. My father was in publishing. My mother, too. That's how they met. So we were a family. Just loved books. When I was a child, I'd always have a list of the books that I wanted for Christmas, for my birthday, what have you. That was the best gift anyone could give me. And so I just wrote. I thought everyone did. That's how you live. You write. You get through things by writing about it. But I think because it was so much a part of my everyday experience, like brushing my teeth, I never thought about becoming a writer. And I was very artistically inclined always into theater and singing. And so, but, you know, I thought, oh, I want to be sensible. I want to be able to make a living. And the Native American community definitely needs lawyers. And so I think I was actually acting out my mother's dream. If she had had the opportunities I did, she would have made a fabulous attorney. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I went that sensible route. And once I was there, all I did was theater. There were a whole bunch of us who you know, we barely did our work. We were always putting on productions. By the time I graduated, we were doing 5 productions per year. That's all we did. And I thought, you know, arts. Maybe I should really do the arts. Mm-hmm. And then Louise Erdrich began publishing her marvelous books, a wonderful Ojibwe author. That inspired me. I thought, oh, my gosh. You know, maybe I could do this. Maybe I could do what I've always done. And that's what I should do.
Yeah. There was a good story associated with The Grass Dancer about how it is that you started what maybe was going to be the first story. It's a good story, and I'm assuming that this actually did really happen.
Well, by the time I started writing The Grass Dancer, I went back to school. Education is always my way. And so I was in an MFA program at the University of Iowa. And it was my first year there. And I was constantly trying to produce new work for our classroom workshops. But I had to have an emergency appendectomy. And I was supposed to be going up in workshop the next week. And while I was on morphine, recovering from surgery, I saw this Dakota woman standing at the foot of my bed, and she had this beautiful beaded buckskin dress on. And I knew that she probably wasn't really there. This was probably morphine, but it was interesting to look at. So I was looking more carefully, and I noticed that she was sort of doing this shuffling dance. And every step she took, there was this sort of puff of something that was jumping up by her feet, and it was reminding me of sort of Pigpen from the Peanuts comic strip. You know, he always has that little bit of dirt around him, and with her it wasn't dirt, but some powdery substance. And so I suddenly said to myself, it's moon dust. It's moon dust. So once I was off the morphine and back in my little apartment, I wrote a story called Moonwalk, where I told the story of what this Dakota woman was doing dancing on the moon dressed in this buckskin dress. And I finished the story and thought, oh, no, I think I've started a novel. Because I knew there were many other it was hinting at so many other stories. And I knew I was going to sort of have to investigate. And it scared me because the idea of a novel just sounds so intimidating sometimes.
Yeah. Well, it's a novel. I suppose it's, in a sense, it's one of those novels that it's a novel in stories. Mm-hmm. And it involves a particular cast of characters spread out over several mm-hmm. generations and kind of jumps around. It's not necessarily linear particularly, but all these people that are really connected. And again, I'd say, you know, a major theme has to do with family history, with how people connect to their roots. It's one of those kinds of things, and how relationships work and how sometimes relationships don't. You said right at the beginning that characters, it's about character, and characters come to you, and then I don't know if they tell the stories or they... You feel like you're trying to figure out, okay, who is this person and what are their experiences? How exactly does that happen?
I don't mean to make it sound as if I'm channeling, you know. So I'm not having that happen. Yeah. I'm having to do an awful lot of work, research. But sometimes it'll be a line. I'll sort of hear in my head a line that I know someone, some invented person is speaking, and I write it down. And I think, okay, well, who is this? Who would say such a thing? Sometimes I'll have a picture in my head. As I did of that woman, they come in different ways, or it'll be in a dream. I'll dream of a character. And for me, I work very slowly. So it takes me a while to figure out who the person is. When were they born? I never seem to want to know just about an isolated character or one set all living in one time stream. I need to go back in time and do all kinds of research about their ancestors, whether I use it or not. And it's so I do an awful lot of work. I wish I could channel if such a thing is possible. But I learn a lot because of these characters. And there's this old dictum that you should write what you know. Most people have heard that, you know, about writing, write what you know. And Marcy Hirschman once said in a talk that you should write what you need to know. And that has served me better. And so I go off of the ground of my own experience quite often in my writing, having to learn about other periods of time, other tribes, other people, the Vietnam War, what have you, to try to do a good job for my characters.
And I think that's really it's something that may indeed surprise people sometimes, that people who write fiction do research, and sometimes a lot of research, so that they can try to make sure that the story is true in as much as they can make it historically accurate, that the details of people's life are right, and that if you're putting a person into a particular historical time, that you get that time right. Why is that? I suppose some people would say, well, you're a writer, it's fiction, you're just making it up. Why does it matter to you that those things are right?
My characters, when I've lived with them for as long as I have, when I'm wrestling with a novel or a story, they become very real to me. I want them to be absolutely real to the reader. I don't want the reader to be pulled out because they say, oh, no, that would never happen, because everyone has a different area of expertise. So if I have a character who served in Vietnam during the war and is a Marine, and then you have a real-life vet reading this, says, oh, God, that's so absurd. She doesn't know what she's talking about. That would never happen. We don't talk that way, et cetera, et cetera. It just kills it. He doesn't believe. And for me, that's just a tragedy, and I don't want that to happen to anyone. So, and I always feel that there is a truth to the fiction, that even though it's invented, there's a spark of some kind of spirit there that I'm trying to honor. And so I do my best to make it as true as possible.
Yeah. Well, our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Susan Power. She's a writer. She lives in St. Paul. She's authored two books. Her first novel, The Grass Dancer, was published in 1994, and her most recent that's in print is Roofwalker. That was published in 2002. She's also contributed stories to Atlantic Monthly and Paris Review. Her work has been selected for inclusion in the Best American Short Stories. She's here visiting the campus as part of the Carr Reading Series, which is presented by the English Department's Creative Writing Program. She will be giving a reading at the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore today at 4:30. That's at 809 South Wright in Champaign. So anyone should feel welcome to stop by and meet her and hear her. And if you wanted to, buy a copy of The Grass Dancer, you probably could. And we're really pleased that she could be here on the show with us. We're going to pause here for just a moment, and then we'll talk some more with Susan. We wanted to take this opportunity to ask people to support the station with their dollars, and we want to make sure we do it because we're actually not going to be doing it all that many times here this week, at least not on Focus 580. It's a shorter fund drive. We've made them shorter in response to people asking us, gosh, couldn't you make them shorter? Yeah, we want to spend as much time as we possibly can on doing the programming. So here's one of those opportunities, though, for you to go to the phone and pick it up and be a supporter of the station, help pay the bills. That's what we're asking for, money. We're asking for money, and that's the money that we're going to use to pay for next year's programs. So if you're not a supporter of the station, now is the time to be counted and to send us some money. 244-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. 866-779-9455 is the toll-free. You can also go online, willpledge.org. Jack Brighton is here.
Hello.
With me. He is often here on this program as a host. He was for a long time the producer. Right now, he's the guy who takes care of our web operations.
Right. And just posing the question, what would WILL be like if we had to count on commercials to raise the money to run the station? You know, we could try to bring you the same kinds of conversations that we're having, like this morning with our guest. We could try to do the same kind of news programs that we do. It just wouldn't be the same. I mean, just go around on the rest of the radio dial and see what you get. And it's, you know, what I want to say that's not, you know, good stuff. It's just different. It's way different. Public radio counts on you to support it because we do the in-depth kinds of interviews, conversational kind of programs like Focus 580. So we hope if you will appreciate that, you will also pick up your telephone and call us right now, 244-9455, to support this program, or go online at willpledge.org and all the programs you hear on this station. Let's check in real quick with Martha Deal, who is one of David's producers at our Pledge Center, and to see how we're doing.
Well, between the last time we talked and now, we've gained $500 in pledges.
Yay!
Yes, and we'd like to see that continue and ask people to think about what's listening to David worth to you? Is that worth a dollar a week? That's $52 a year for a contribution to WIL, and it supports the programming in a very real way. Maybe a dollar a day, $365. And it helps pay for the news information and the kinds, it pays the phone calls for when David doesn't have a guest in the studio like today and keeps on bringing you the information we like to pass along. So please go to the phone, call 244-9455, toll free 866-779-9455, or log on the computer, willpledge.org, and help continue the service we bring you.
Absolutely. And, you know, we could just put on national programming. We could put on Talk of the Nation or Diane Rehm or, oh, come on, they're fine shows.
They're fine shows. They're not David and
Jack,
admit it, they're a little on the boring side.
Oh, well, I'm not going to admit that, but, you know, I have to say that Focus 580 brings something special, and one of the things that it brings is obviously David Inge, and also you, Martha Deal, and Harriet Williamson, the producers of the show. I mean, these are people who pay attention to what's going on, not just nationally, internationally, but also locally, to see what kind of issues we need to cover here at WILL, not NPR, not someone else. The kind of program that is unique to this area and to this station, and to you, the audience, the people who we're here to serve. So you appreciate that, I'm sure. So please let us know with your support. 217-244-9455 is the pledge line.
All right. Thank you both very much. We'll talk again at the end of the show. We will, of course, here continue to talk with our guest, Susan Power. She is here visiting the campus. Again, this is part of the fall 2007 Car Reading Series. It's presented by the English Department's Creative Writing Program, and now for a long time they have been bringing writers to the campus so that they can meet with students and that other people can have the opportunity to hear from them and hear them actually read from their work. And as I said, Susan will be giving a reading this afternoon at 4:30 in the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore. And there will be some other folks coming here later this fall and also next spring. And we hope to have a number of them here on the program so you can have the opportunity to hear from them. If you'd like to call in, that's certainly possible too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. In the stories that you tell, have you made an effort to actually go back and, say, recover some stories, or are you in a sense making your own stories? They might deal with traditional themes in a sense, but that they're your stories and not some story that you might have heard or that might have been told and might have been, you know, in existence that way?
That's a wonderful question. It really is. I think I am trying to do a little bit of recovery. I'm trying to sort of bring my people, my experience from the past into the present and also propel them into the future. You know, we're still here. We aren't gone. And there are a lot of people out there that don't really know that. and I'm certainly trying to honor the experiences we've had and many of the stories. When I say stories, I don't mean just some sort of legend or myth. I mean story in terms of belief system, a whole belief system, trying to preserve that because there is so much wisdom there that is unique. And as I said, I'm all for diversity and for all of us to be exposed to many people's stories. So I'm trying to preserve that, bring that into the here and now, because many of us do live with those stories still alive in our present contemporary lives. And I'm also trying to meld it with the other stories that I've come to know, given my vast travels throughout the world. It's a really tricky thing, but that's what I do. That's why I'm slow, perhaps, having to work and rework and trying to blend things in this way that I'm honoring the past, but also bringing it into the present and the future.
Mm-hmm. One of the I'm sure that somewhere I have read the term magical realism applied to your writing. And sometimes I think I know what that means, and other times I guess I'm not exactly sure what that is. There are probably a lot of writers to whom that could be applied who may or may not be happy about that or think that was okay. Is that a term that you – maybe I should even ask what do you think that means, and is that a term that you can identify with?
I'm probably not the person to give you a wonderful definition of that. even though I went to law school, it seems like after that I resisted all academic sort of ways of thinking about things. And so when I went to the University of Iowa, I went as someone who didn't know the language of the workshop. Mm-hmm. And I'm what they call an intuitive writer. And so those sorts of labels or what have you, I just completely ignored. But in my understanding, it is a strategy that some authors use to make a statement about the world. And to exaggerate conditions, to exaggerate a situation. I think it's misapplied when it's used with reference to my work, because for me, I'm writing about my reality, the reality of people who raised me. And so when I have a situation, I have something happening, like an old woman who dies when a little bit ahead of time because she wants to make a statement to the world, and then she ends up, her spirit ends up dancing on the moon. I try to use mundane details to really ground this event, to make it seem unextraordinary, because I want people to get the feeling that, oh, these sorts of things do happen, can happen, happen all the time. So for me, it is reality. It is someone's reality. Mm. It's not some other supernatural sort of thing.
Yeah. I think that's really interesting, because I – maybe that's the thing that that makes the difference, is that you as a reader read a certain story and things happen in there, and you would say, well, okay, well, that really can't happen, and yet it's the reality of the characters' lives as far as they're concerned. That's not supernatural. That's just life, and so maybe that's what we're really talking about, is something on the one hand that as to you as a reader seems like another reality, but as far as the characters are concerned, that's just the place that they are.
And there are an awful lot of listeners out there who, if they took off the glasses of what they're used to, accustomed to, would see that some of their own beliefs can look absolutely surreal and bizarre to outsiders. So, for example, I was raised Catholic. I'm a lapsed Catholic, so I'm Catholic no longer. But it was a rich, wonderful upbringing, and it was mixed with Dakota beliefs, and my mother was able to blend all these things seamlessly. And when you take apart what we're taught as Catholics, that every week you are eating literally the body and the blood of your deity, that can sound very strange to someone outside of that mm-hmm. tradition, and has caused a lot of the rifts between different factions within Christianity. So just as one example.
Yeah. There are in the stories, there are also one of the themes, I suppose, is I don't know exactly how to put it, is power. That there is in nature, in the world, there is power. And that it is possible for people, if you know how to do this right, to tap into that, which I suppose makes some people honored and makes other people suspect. And maybe it depends on what it is you decide to do with it. But particularly it's interesting, this idea that there is power there, and it's possible for you to use that to your advantage. That's an interesting idea, and something that I think probably for a lot of people would say that's way beyond their daily experience.
Before I respond to that, now he's not paying me money to say this, so I'm really just saying this on absolutely honestly. I've done so many radio interviews. I've never been asked as many fabulous questions.
Oh, well.
Wearing a hat. Seriously, he didn't pay me for that. Actually, now that I'm getting older, and I'm slowly making my way towards finishing two other novels, I look back on my writing experience, and I realize that really, rather than becoming a writer, being something that is a career, is the career part of my life, it has been a spiritual journey. And I am getting to the issue you raised. And that I went from someone who believed in all sorts of things to a period of time in my 20s and 30s when I didn't believe in anything. I wrote as if I did, but oh my God, I was just incensed and angry at all the people of faith, and now have completely turned that around. And so I realize I've been wrestling with these issues in my writing all along. And so this issue about power and how we use power, you know, I think all of us have power of some kind, or at least the potential of it, charisma, an incredible talent, an incredible knowledge. And the challenge for each and every one of us is, how are we going to use that? Are we going to use this for our selfish purposes, or are we going to use it for the good of the community, however you define community in terms of your neighborhood, your nation, or all people? And so again and again, even though specifically you'll be hearing about it in terms of Native America, I'm really writing about why we are all here, what is our sacred path, if we have one, what do we believe, what are you going to choose to do, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you yourself believe that there are some people who have that kind of power? And I guess I'm talking about almost in the mystical sense that some of your characters do, that that they have the power to get, let's just say, even, you know, one-to-one human relationships. That there are some people who really, wherever it comes from, however this works, that there are people who really do have the power to get other people to do what they want.
Absolutely. We've seen throughout history, some people are given more gifts than others. And sometimes they use those gifts in ways that really enhance the human condition. And sometimes they, you know, you just compare an Adolf Hitler and his menacing charisma and magnetism to a Gandhi. And you see the different ripples that extended from how they used or misused their power, their charm, their intelligence, their eloquence, on and on. You know.
I suppose though you have to make the argument that those two individuals or other people would never have been able to do what they did unless a lot of people believed in their power. So I suppose that does get back to the idea that, in a sense, if a person has that power, it's because we have given it to them, because we believe that they have it. And it wouldn't somehow, if we thought, you know, this person doesn't have the whatever it is, then I guess they wouldn't.
I think what's happening there is this figure, mesmerizes us. Mm-hmm. Are they appealing to our higher self, or are they appealing to our lower self? Are they speaking to our fears, our hurts, our angers? So, for example, in post-World War I Germany, where people feel so deflated, they feel they've lost this terrible war. They've been the ego of their country, their nation, has been crushed to a certain extent. So here comes this charismatic man who says, we can rise from the ashes of World War I and not just be a better nation, but, you know, by God, we could rule the world. Mm-hmm. You know, and whereas you have someone else who isn't just telling people, being provocative in terms of the kinds of choices that they should make, but is also really trying to live by example. You know, I'm just reading about Gandhi. I'm so impressed with what he was trying to do. And sort of in ways, our former president Kennedy, you know, when he said, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country, calling upon us to rise to this challenge of service. And I, you know, sadly, I think right now, and I'm not being a partisan, I'm talking about all leaders on both sides. I just feel we don't have people calling on us to be our higher selves, and I think it's a real sadness. And so, you know, maybe it's falling on artists, on filmmakers, and songwriters, and fiction writers to try to wake people up and say, hey, who are we listening to? Who do we revere?
I think that some of your strongest, most interesting characters are women. Not to say that there's anything wrong with the men in the books, but the women really do seem to stand out. How do you feel about trying to write the experiences of men?
I have to work harder at it, and so in an unpublished novel that I will eventually produce. Right now I'm working on it. I'm finishing a different one, and then I'm going to go back to War Bundles. I have a Vietnam vet character who's a major character in the book. He narrates a third of the book. So what I did is I found some Vietnam vet readers who will be my guy readers, who will check not only for things that happened to them as Marines and what have you, but just as men. Where is this voice just sounding inauthentic? I struggle with it, unless it's an elderly man. For some reason, I can do elderly man voices. I don't know why, because my grandfathers, I never got to know them. But I think the reason women are just always front and center and just sort of take over my work, it's because the people in my life who are the strongest, the most outspoken, the most courageous, both physically, morally, were women. My grandmother was a leader. My mother was a leader. She's still alive, but now she's elderly, and so she's quieted down a little bit. My father was much gentler, and he left sort of the business of sit-ins and getting arrested to my mother. And so women sort of rule the world in my universe, and it freaks some people out sometimes. I had a professor at the University of Iowa who was just a little thrown by this, and we had a one-on-one conference, and he said, you know, are you a feminist?
You couldn't even bring himself to say the word.
Took him a few tries, and I said, well, why do you ask? And he said, because all of the men in your work are either peripheral or you kill them off pretty quickly. I love men. I absolutely love men. It's just the way I was raised.
Yeah, okay. Our guest is Susan Power. She's the author of two novels, The Grass Dancer and Roof Walker, and is working on a couple of others, and one day they will also see print. She's visiting here the campus of the University of Illinois to take part in the CAR reading series that's presented by the English Department's Creative Writing Program. So she'll be giving a reading this afternoon on the campus at the Illini Union Bookstore, and we'll be also meeting with student writers, and we're pleased to have her here. We've, over time, have had a number of writers who visited town in the series here to talk about their work, and it's always a lot of fun. So if someone wanted to get in a quick question here, we have maybe about 5 minutes left. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I do like that man in the story. Now I can't remember the man's name, but this is the man who's taken to sleeping in the shed because
Herod.
He and his wife is decided that she's still interested, and he's not quite sure what to do with that. I guess I'm beginning to identify with people at that age, just in the sense that that what happens to you as you age is that you have to find different ways to define what your, if we go back to this power notion, you got to have different ways to define your strengths, you know, particularly when you get to the point where maybe your physical strength isn't what it was, and you wonder, okay, well, what is my strength anymore? And I think I like that character.
I had so much fun with Herod. And again, you know, elderly men, I can do their voices. I don't know why. And I had another teacher at the University of Iowa who said, Susan, you do elderly love really well. And she said, why is that? And I said, wow, no one ever told me that. Why would that be? And I had to think about it. And then I realized when I was little and would go to powwows in the city or all throughout the country, The older people were the ones who were allowed to cut up and have more fun. This was not a culture celebrating youth. The elders had earned their day in the sun. They had raised their children, were helping to raise their grandchildren, had worked hard, and now they could have fun and they could tease and flirt and, you know, say kind of risque things. So I always stuck to the little old ladies to dance with them because they had way more fun. So when I think of sexy people coming into their sexual powers, it's the elderly. And I have an unpublished piece with an elderly woman who talks about her many marriages and her continuing boyfriends and sex life. And I gave a reading at a nursing home a couple years ago, reading this section. And oh my God, and there were some sex scenes. And afterwards, seriously, one old man was waving his cane. People were cheering. They said, thank God, people think it's all over. And you know, we have no interest in all of this anymore. And bless you, bless you.
For those of us who are now solidly in middle age, it at least it gives us something to look forward to. I think that that's really interesting. Is now, do you think, I guess particularly in the Native community, and I don't mean you free to speak to the whole Native community, is that, does that still stand? Does that, or there, are they struggling here with this same thing that we seem to be so, just no, the idea of getting old is just like poison.
I think we're still doing pretty well with that. I think elders are definitely so revered, so absolutely revered. You know, every now and then I'm seeing that there's more and more of a focus on the tiny tots. You know, there's so much focus now on competitions at many of our powwows and the children, the tiny tots. And, you know, we're influenced by mainstream society just like anyone else. But we're still hanging in there. Mm. And I know most of my Native women friends, we are finding that we're becoming happier the older we get. And we feel we're coming into our powers and not in any way losing them. Mm. And so.
Well, how does that happen? Is it just it's something that is there, however we define this power, whatever it is, it's just something there all along that was just waiting for you, and you say, well, why did it take me so long to figure this out?
I should make it sound easy. Really, I know, from just speaking for myself personally, it's been a lot of work. It's been a lot of work to stop being distracted by what television and magazines and all sorts of others are telling me about what my worth is, and getting to a place where I realize as I push ego more and more out of the way, and you know, I really try to honor other people and honor my work and honor myself, I just get happier and healthier and have a better sense of myself. And but it has been a long road, and it has been work.
What is, as you think about what kind of stories that you'd like to tell maybe in the future that you haven't done yet, is there something that's just sort of itching at you that you think, you know, there's a story here, there's something that I really want to write about? Maybe I'm not quite ready to do that, but I know that at some point that's going to be there.
I don't know that I can look beyond the present project I'm trying to finish up this year. It's a novel called Our Lady of the New World, and I have the Virgin Mary as a major character, and actually I'm very far off my ground. There's only one Dakota, and he dies very quickly. So there are Mohawks, and there are Norwegians, and there are Ojibwe people, and most of it's set in St. Paul in contemporary times, but there's a whole section in ancient Nazareth, and a section in 1622 in what is now New York State. So, bringing a whole strange cast of characters together, and it's a very spiritual book, and it's been a hard but really rewarding journey for me, writing this book.
Where did that come from?
Brushing my teeth. I was preparing for my last day of class teaching at the University of Minnesota, feeling sad because I had the most wonderful students, and I just had these characters come into my head, and all of it happening, you know, in my crazy brain. But it took a few years to sort it all out and start to put it all together and to realize what are the themes, what am I exploring, what am I trying to say. So I'm almost done. I'm going to be reading from this work today.
Oh, okay. So again, people can hear that if they go down to the bookstore. What, as you work with young writers, is there some consistent kind of a thing? Obviously, each person maybe needs something different. So if you work with people one-on-one, you're not going to be telling each of those different people the same thing. But is there something that you try to give to young writers or tell young writers that it doesn't matter who they are or what it is they think that they're trying to do, it's the same kind of advice that you would get everyone?
Well, the first thing I tell them is that they have to find what works for them. So if a writer comes to town and says, every day you have to write for 6 hours a day, or you have to read X number of books every week, whatever, well, that worked for that person. They can't necessarily extrapolate from that. And I also tell them that usually, well, I believe this isn't just true of writing, but almost any endeavor, to do it for the sake of that endeavor. So to write for writing's sake, to really try to put everything that you have into the poem or the story or the book, rather than to say, I want to be rich and famous. I want to do that. I want to do that. And I like to quote Michael Jordan. I don't remember the exact words he used, but he was talking about how when he was in college, he just wanted to be a better basketball player. And if he had ever held in front of himself the goal of becoming as rich and famous as he became, he would never have achieved that success, that it was this goal of becoming a better ball player. Mm-hmm. So for me, still, even though I've been published, I'm always trying to become a better writer.
Do you have young writers who actually think that they're going to get rich being a writer?
Oh, sure. And the first story they write, they send off to the New Yorker. And if it gets rejected, well, it's all over.
Wow. That amazes me, just knowing how few writers actually manage to make a living from their writing. Most people could not. If they had to live off what they had made writing, they would have starved a long time ago. And to actually, you know, to have your first novel be picked up and get $1 million, well, yeah, every once in a while that happens. But most writers, they don't have that kind of experience.
Oh, absolutely. But yeah, kids out there are constantly saying, asking about the money and asking about the glory and asking him, what glory?
Well, we're pretty much at the point here where we're going to have to wind down this part of Focus. But I do want to mention again that you can read the two novels offered by our guest, Susan Power. They are The Grass Dancer and Roof Walker. And she's working on some others that soon we'll see print. She will be giving a reading at the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore. And someone called in and said perhaps I misspoke on the time here, so I want to make sure that they do it correct. 4:30. I may have said 3:30. I don't know. But anyway, 4:30 today, and this is at the Illini Union Bookstore at 809 South Wright in the Author's Corner. Anyone certainly should feel welcome to stop by. Our guest, Susan Power, is here sponsored by the Carr Reading Series that's presented by the English Department's Creative Writing Program. And I think probably later this fall and maybe next spring we'll have some more writers who will be here, and we'll talk with them as well. Thank you very much for
being
here. We appreciate it.